Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Well, happy Friday. And I think the question on everyone's mind is, what in the world is going on between Donald Trump and Elon Musk, the basically power couple of Washington, D.C.? And they've had a very, very good relationship up until yesterday when everything seemed to implode. So just to catch you up really quick, what happened is that as late as Wednesday evening, Trump was playing down kind of any conflicts. We were seeing that there was some disagreement and difference of opinion on the One Big Beautiful Bill and all of that. But Trump was still downplaying that. But yesterday, man, it just all disappeared. So 13 minutes into an Oval Office meeting with the German Chancellor, Trump started laying out all of his complaints with Musk. And that just started a chain reaction that went really public as well. So both of these two men, you have the most powerful man in the world, the richest man in the world, just going at it very publicly on social media. And Musk also saying on social media, "I'm sorry, but I just can't stand it anymore. This massive, outrageous, pork-filled congressional spending bill is a disgusting abomination. Shame on those who voted for it. You know you did wrong. You know it." And he also talked about the EV incentive cuts in the bill and didn't like that. So Trump is then calling Musk crazy. And then Musk says, "Well, Trump is in the Epstein files. Have a great day, DJT," which was probably the lowest blow, if we're being honest, of the whole thing. That, you know, it's some of those personal attacks, you just don't really need to go there. But overall, this was a relationship that is typical for Trump world, right? Because everything in Trump world is transactional. DC is transactional overall, but even more, I think, condensed and crystallized in Trump world, everything is about the transaction. And so this was going to reach a head at some point. I personally did not expect it to happen this soon. But when you have Elon, who donated over $250 million to Trump's campaign and really took credit, and I think that's fair, he took credit for Trump's 2024 win. I think that that wouldn't have happened absent Elon's donation. Now, of course, it's not all on Elon. Of course, you know, Trump has a very loyal following in and of himself, but he needed money, right? And so Elon stepped up. But Elon, this wasn't philanthropic on his part. It wasn't just because, you know, he loves America. This is, of course, transactional for him too. He's thinking he's buying influence. He's buying policy decisions. He's buying personnel appointments, including his pick for the NASA head, which then Trump pulls as well. And I think that was a catalyst that just pushed Elon over the edge, going, okay, my $300 million investment, what am I really getting for it except for, you know, a couple of media interviews, tanking stock prices, and personal threats? This isn't what I signed up for. I think potentially Elon went into this with a little bit of naivete in the sense that he may have had the framework that Trump did in his first term of thinking, you know what, I will go in, head the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, and I'm going to fix things. And I'm going to go into Washington. You know, it's Mr. Musk goes to Washington, like Mr. Smith, right? And I'm going to fix things, and it's going to be great, and everybody's going to love me, and you know, woohoo, let's go save America, guys. And, you know, and this very, like, kind of bright-eyed, bushy-tailed view. And he ran smack up into the same wall ironically, that Trump did, right, in his first term. And he's seeing that it's not that easy. You can't just executive your way into all of the fixes that Washington needs. And Trump, meanwhile, is saying, okay, you know, you invested in me, but now I have the power. I'm the president, and I'll take it under advisement. But he's not seeing Elon Musk ever as co-anything, right? I mean, and this is Trump we're talking about. He doesn't share anything well. He's always the executive. He's the top. He's the decision maker. And so he's thinking, well, you know, if this doesn't work and I'm making the art of the deal, I don't really need to consult Elon. And if he doesn't get everything he wants, well, too bad, because, you know, this is Washington and this is the art of the deal. And so you have, I think, two very different mindsets that approached the office of the presidency, the policy, and DOGE in particular, which I think is a mistake for Trump, by the way, because this is a signature agenda that is part of the overall Trump mandate that not only his base, the MAGA base, but the overall conservative base voted for. Everybody's saying, we voted for this. We love what Elon's doing. We want the DOGE cuts to reach the spending package. And even in the last week, even MAGA has been very concerned at what's come out in this big, beautiful bill. But the bottom line is, whenever there's a relationship, whether it's personal, it's business, or especially if it's political, you got to have what the law calls a meeting of the minds. I don't think that happened here. I don't think that there was a meeting of the minds, and it just became so crystallized and evidenced over the last week that now the richest man in the world, the most powerful man in the world, who are, yeah, two narcissistic personalities that are used to just going scorched earth on their opponents because they know that they can just outlast their opponents, are now using the very same tack against each other. And we are seeing this basically national divorce in front of our eyes that is really, frankly, embarrassing. Like, this is not what I voted for. This is not, like go into a room, talk about it, you know, do what you have to, art of the deal, you know, whatever. Go, you know, split the, go Marie Kondo on the whole thing and, you know, say what part of the big, beautiful bill brings you joy, right? And then, and divide your assets, like, figure it out. But don't do it so publicly that is genuinely embarrassing that, you know, all of the memes today are basically, what is Elon writing in the slam book like Mean Girls, right? So I'm frankly disappointed in everybody, but this was obvious. This was something that was, we saw, and it was an inevitability for anybody who's been around Trump world for more than 5 minutes. This was going to happen. I just didn't expect it to happen so soon. So let's bring in John Cardillo, who is a GOP strategist and I know has a lot of thoughts about this. And John, thanks for listening to my rant on this. And, you know, your thoughts overall on Elon versus Trump instead of Elon times Trump.
Yeah, so Jenna, thanks for that intro, because that was definitely a perfect and very accurate recap of what happened. Look, let's assume for a moment, I mean, there's some speculation, and I'm not buying it, that this is some kind of theater, you know, K-pop theater, like professional wrestling, where these guys plan this. I don't buy that, because some pretty egregious things were said by both. And Elon also made a comment. It was a lot more benign, but I think very powerful. He said, well, you know, up to paraphrase, this is what he said about Jared, meaning Elon's pick for NASA. And Trump had written a very complimentary multi-paragraph post about how qualified this guy was. I have to side with Elon on this one for many of the reasons you stated. First of all, the guy donated $250 million. He made a massive, massive donation so that we could take back the White House and take back control of Congress. We win. Would it have killed them to give him something? Because everybody is acting very naive and very idealistic and saying, well, Elon is wrong. The elites shouldn't have this kind of power in politics. Well, maybe not, but they do. That's our system. Everybody, every politician on the planet, from the local school board level up to the president of the United States, has donors. You need them. It's part of the game. You need them to win. You need them to even be competitive. And look, face it. Like you said, nobody donates massive amounts of money unless there's some benefit for them. That's why there's money in the political process. Elon donated a ridiculously large amount of money. The guy didn't ask for much. Already wanted his EV credits. Now both sides are saying he never asked for that. Maybe he didn't. So let's take those off the table. Why in the world couldn't they give this guy his Mass pick? Yeah. The guy got nothing, and he helped us win. So in my opinion, the GOP did what it does best. It snatches defeat from the jaws of victory like no other movement in history. You had the golden goose. The right finally had its George Soros, only with much deeper pockets, exponentially deeper pockets. And in 4.5 months, they managed to destroy that relationship. And I think we're blaming, you know, so many people are pointing fingers at Elon. He should have done this and he should have gone quiet. Okay, maybe we can critique him stylistically. But in reality, in the final analysis, the man invested $250 million into our process. They made him run around and fire thousands of people at federal agencies, some warranted, but many veterans that I think the administration is going to have a PR problem with down the road. Many veterans who were recruited into those government jobs. Now you got to think about, you know, Elon's mindset. Here's a very math and science minded guy, a guy who doesn't really infuse emotion into decisions. He said, look, I just wasted 4.5 months of my life. I fired all these people. There are no cuts. They're going to reappropriate that money into massive social welfare programs in this bill. I'm going to speak up. And when he spoke up, he was viciously attacked. Yesterday, following every word from both Trump and Elon, I think they both should have done this privately, but I can understand the guy's frustration, and I can absolutely understand why he took the argument public. I might not agree with it, but I can understand it. I mean, they should have given him. It would not have killed the GOP to throw him a bone or two. That they didn't is, like, inexplicable to me.
Well, and it would have been, to your point, John Cardillo, it would have been more strategic to keep your ally, to keep the funding. I mean, everybody is like, oh, you know, Trump is super wealthy. I mean, yeah, but he needed Elon's money. I mean, we all know this from the 2024 election. And you can't get $300 million in exchange for nothing. I mean, that's just not true in any scenario, but especially in politics and especially D.C. And so I think everything that you said is accurate. And the interesting question that actually, because I had so many reporters reach out to me yesterday, and one of the questions that I got was, what does this mean for the Silicon Valley tech bro kind of MAGA relationship? And I think this is actually the most interesting question moving forward, because, you know, my response is that it won't matter all that much if the Democrats win back the House in the midterms, which right now kind of seems likely. Like, if something doesn't happen pretty quickly to repair this, to win back the trust of the base for the One Big Beautiful Bill debacle, you know, then if the Democrats win back the House in the midterms, Trump's presidency will effectively become lame duck. Like, it'll be over. And MAGA and the conservative base see DOGE as central to the Trump mandate that they voted for. So anybody rational is going, well, why? Like, what did we get as well, right? Because, I mean, yeah, I didn't invest $300 million, but I invested my vote, my support, and the American people know that that's kind of a big deal, especially when the 2024 election was, you know, a really big deal, and this was like, this is the last chance to save America and all this stuff. So we have a buy-in as well. I mean, you know, similarly, at least in theory, to Elon. But the real question about this, John, that I want your take on is what this means for J.D. Vance and the future of the GOP, because Trump hasn't actually named him heir apparent. And that's likely because Vance was funded by Peter Thiel and the tech bros. Even his first Senate campaign, as you know, and all listeners will recall, in Ohio, he was down. He was like fourth in polling until Trump came and endorsed him and saved him. But this is also the key reason he was selected to be VP, to solidify that relationship between tech bros and Trump. But now that it's maybe and will continue to be unless there's some repair, Trump versus the tech bros, which side is Vance on? Because he can't play both sides when you have Trump, who absolutely demands loyalty, but then you have Elon and Peter Thiel, who are like, we funded you, bro. And so, interestingly, Vance has been basically radio silent on X, yeah. And that probably means he can't play both sides. And so whoever he eventually comes out on, out for, you know, will determine whether or not he gets an endorsement in 2028 or whether we really have an open primary. So I think the question of kind of Vance and the tech bro MAGA relationship is central to the analysis here.
Yeah, look, 100%. I'm really glad you brought up the midterms, Jenna, because I think this absolutely puts them into play in the wrong way, right? The Democrats are going to take advantage of this. Elon is making a lot of statements that are making the markets uneasy. And if the markets are uneasy and we don't get a little bit of financial easing by next year, we're in a lot of trouble for the midterms. And let me make something really clear to the audience. You know this, and I think many in your audience do as well, because they're pretty politically astute. Speaker Hakeem Jeffries, which is almost a guarantee, is going to make Nancy Pelosi look like a centrist. This guy is a radical lunatic. I originally from New York, I know his politics, I know the people around him. This is a very dangerous guy. If people thought Pelosi was a leftist, they have no idea what's coming if Dems take back the House and Jeffries gets the Speaker gavel. And that being said, you know, your point about J.D. is interesting, because yesterday, as this whole Trump-Elon war was happening, there were sub-conversations about J.D. What he's going to do is, in the heir apparent, Trump doesn't have him out front. I think J.D.'s in a really tough spot right now because, you know, he's younger, number one. So those who gravitate toward him were big Elon fans. And that's the other problem, is that, you know, up to, you know, 48 hours ago, there's an extreme faction of MAGA who thought Elon walked on water. And he could do no wrong. He was the greatest guy in the world. They were ready to mobilize citizen patrols to protect Tesla dealerships. Well, he has one disagreement with Trump, which started in a pretty benign way. The post on X, right, formerly Twitter, that started it all, Jenna, was a pretty benign post in which Elon didn't even mention Trump's name. And I to paraphrase it, they basically just blamed Congress, you know, about the bill. And for whatever reason, Trump chimed in, and then the real fight started. I'm going to take away all your subsidies. And Elon, well, I'm going to dismantle the Dragon spaceship program. I mean, it escalated. Now, let me go back to one point you raised earlier in the show. Elon was very careful in his wording about the Epstein files. He never accused Trump of criminality. He merely said Trump is in the files. And there's a lot of speculation that he is, but in a positive way, that he's referenced as a witness for the prosecution. I do not believe, I want to put this out there, I do not believe Donald Trump is in the Epstein files in any negative way. And I can tell you why. I spoke to one of the FBI agents on the Epstein case back in 2009. I knew one of the victim's rights attorneys who were representing his victims. Both that FBI agent and the victim's rights attorney told me Donald Trump was one of the prosecution's best assets. When he found out what Epstein was up to with kids, it turned his stomach. He banned him from Mar-a-Lago and his other properties, and he cooperated with law enforcement, telling them anything they wanted to know. So on that front, I didn't like that Elon did that, but he was very careful from a defamation standpoint to say he's in the files. He never said in what way, in what capacity. So if Trump is in the files as having assisted the prosecution, well, yeah, he's in there, but what Elon said isn't defamatory, nor does it implicate Trump in anything nefarious, which I can tell you, everybody in South Florida, every law enforcement person I know involved in the Epstein case, said Trump was nothing but a prosecution asset.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that you raised that.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you raised that, John, because that was the one thing. I mean, for as much as I agree overall, and I think I'm team Elon in this, in the sense that, you know, Doge should have been codified. Yeah. He should have gotten his peg, you know, all of those things. It was a low blow. And you're right. And I posted on social yesterday, you know, that I share that opinion, that I don't think that Trump is in any way in the Epstein files in a way that has criminal liability, only because if that were the case, then why would we have needed the Russia hoax, the Steele dossier, all of Spygate? Exactly. I mean, all of that stuff. They would have just redacted the rest of it or just released the portion. If they actually had evidence showing that, that would have come out in November, October, you know, October of 2015. And that would have been the October surprise. Nobody would have cared about Hillary. I mean, all of that. So just logically, that doesn't make sense. But then also, to your point, I have heard the same thing from people who have actually seen the Epstein files, that Trump is only mentioned in the positive way. But yes, also that Elon, and this is where people have to be very careful on social media, because Elon's post was crafted to lead readers to the conclusion that if Trump is mentioned, therefore it's bad. But he didn't actually say that. And so it probably does skirt any sort of defamation claim. And so, you know, Trump may end up suing him over it. Who knows? Because he's Trump. He's probably yelling at his lawyers, you know, yesterday and this morning on that. I've been on the receiving end of some of those phone calls, having to be like, okay, let's analyze this. Give me a couple hours, you know, like let's massage this out. But, you know, and he may very well sue over it, but it's one of those things that I don't think that ultimately, I mean, we wouldn't even get a conclusion to litigation for years over that, and it won't matter.
Yeah, yeah.
But it also is something that it's just, you know, Elon, I think, was very careful in that, but it was intended to be a low personal blow that maybe signals to me that their relationship, at least right now, is beyond public disagreement over policy. It's now become personal.
Oh, 100%. I mean, when you, let's face it, I mean, we're in agreement, Jenna, right? We can both, you know, disclaim the nefarious implication in the tweet, and we're like mine with that. But, you know, somebody implies that you engage in that kind of behavior. I mean, for most people, especially men, that's a point of no return, right?
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's hard to come back from that. But, you know, to another point you made, I think that the other issue everybody's overlooking here is, okay, we talked about the $250 million Elon invested. If things went well, he might have invested $500 million and kept Republicans in power indefinitely. But he also controls X, which is arguably the most powerful political platform on the planet. Everybody in media is on that. I mean, we're on Instagram, we're on Facebook, but let's face it, we use X. And as a rapid response tool, nothing even comes close to get information out there about an issue or policy or to push back on one. It's not going to take Elon much to throttle Trump. He can, you know, wipe out every one of the accounts that support Trump. So I think you're not just picking a fight with Elon and his money. You're picking a fight with him and arguably the most important political messaging platform on the planet. And I think Republicans need to think twice before attacking this guy, because messaging is as important as money in politics.
Yeah, really well said. Well, John, we got to take a break here, but I mean, there's so much more that could be said. And my hope ultimately for all of this is that somehow Trump and Musk stop both acting like children, get it together, figure it out for the good of America, put America first and the whole mandate ahead of personal grievance, and, you know, stop just, you know, bomb throwing for the relationship. I mean, you know, anybody knows when you're mad at a friend or, you know, you want out of a relationship or whatever, that's when you go personal and you just go scorched earth, because then it just doesn't care. And that's the signal to the person. But there's still a possibility, hopefully, of repair before it goes on too long. And we do win or lose the midterms, rather. So I just hope that that there's some repair that comes out of this, but it'll be interesting, especially for a Friday. But a lot more news about the Supreme Court coming up next. We'll be right back with more. This June 24th marks 3 years since Roe v. Wade was overturned. But here's what you may not know. Abortion numbers have surged to a 10-year high. The battleground has shifted from the courtroom to our homes. Today, over 60% of abortions happen through the abortion pill, taken in silence and often alone. Preborn Network clinics are standing in the gap, meeting women in their most desperate hour. And here's what they're seeing. Young mothers, terrified and misled, are delivering their babies, tiny, perfectly formed, onto bathroom floors. These precious babies, once called just tissue, now are lifeless. 11% of these women who take the abortion pill will suffer serious health complications. Countless others carry emotional scars for a lifetime. When you give to Preborn, you're not just saving a baby, you're saving a mother as well. You're giving her hope, financial support, and the truth. Preborn has already rescued over 350,000 babies, but there are so many more who need our help. Your tax-deductible gift makes this mission possible. To donate now, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, until the big Trump-Elon divorce, the bigger headline yesterday that has kind of, fallen to the wayside, but we need to actually talk about it, is the Supreme Court. So the justices sent a message to the American public on Thursday. We're not as divided as you think. Of the 6 rulings that were released, 4 were unanimous, including opinions in high-profile battles over reverse discrimination and faith-based tax breaks. So let's break it all down with Gerard Folletti, who is senior counsel for the Lawfare Project. Gerard, did this surprise you that 4 were unanimous, and even in one of these opinions, it was Justice Sotomayor that actually wrote the majority opinion that seemed shockingly well-drafted?
Justice Sotomayor for one, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson for another. It might seem surprising, but when you think about it, it's really not. Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, it's been a hallmark of his Supreme Court to try to get as much unanimity and consensus as possible. So he's been moving the court in the direction of, let's see how we can all understand the law in the same way. It's really not that surprising, but it is a good sign that there is agreement on such basic principles.
Yeah, so, and I agree with that. And so, you know, maybe there's hope for the high court, even though we have, you know, a lot of problems, as we've discussed at length on this program, with the federal bench otherwise. But let's get into some of these rulings and what they actually mean. So the reverse discrimination court, the court was considering whether members of a majority group, such as straight white males, should have to meet a higher burden of proof in order to make an employment discrimination claim. And that, of course, lost. And that, I think, is a good thing.
It's a very good thing. And when you think about it, the unanimity here is for the proposition that every individual receives the same protection under federal discrimination law. That's equality. That's a very basic principle that the Supreme Court agrees on. And imposing a higher standard on a member of a majority group to prove discrimination is not something that's constitutional. That's something that I think it's fair to say that the Supreme Court fairly easily agreed on. And it's a very common sense ruling.
Yeah. And so does that in any way contradict any of the left's push, at least in the court of public opinion, on the 1964 Civil Rights Act or anything like that, when they're suggesting, and they have been for a long time, that, you know, the straight white male is the only one that can't be oppressed in the United States? And, you know, under a kind of a critical race theory type of mantra, that if you are a straight white male, then you are always the oppressor. You're never oppressed in the context of a potential discrimination claim.
The problem with the left's oppression narrative is that oppression is not a legal concept. Discrimination is. So when you claim that something or someone is oppressed, that's a moral judgment. That's something that you believe or you think or you wish to believe. It's not something that's definable under discrimination standards. So the left has been trying to move the ball to go away from what is legally understood, how we understand discrimination, treating someone unequally, and creating a whole different narrative where even if the law is met, even if it's not discriminatory, discriminatory, someone can still be oppressed. But the Supreme Court is saying, wait a second, let's look at what the law actually is. And the law provides for equality under the law. It provides for protection from discrimination. Oppression is not a legal standard. Oppression is a wishy-washy emotional response by the left when they can't prove discrimination.
What a great response. And I think that I want to underscore that point, that the Supreme Court is actually for once unanimously not borrowing the touchy-feely, emotionally triggered responses from the left and are actually looking at a legal standard. I think we need more of that. And we need to continue in the court of public opinion to draw those distinctions and say, well, we may feel a certain way about something, but here's what the law actually says. And if we extrapolate that to a lot of other things, like, for example, immigration right now, a lot of other things like when life begins and so-called abortion rights instead of the protections that the law requires for every human being, then we get to, obviously, the legal and the proper conclusions instead of these emotion-charged arguments from the left. So even though this is a good decision, we've seen a lot of that sort of hyperbolic, over-emotional extremism from justices like Sotomayor and Kagan and Jackson. And so what do you think made the difference here? Was it just that this was one that they could get away with the left because it wasn't something like, you know, LGBTQ-fueled or, you know, abortion or something like that?
Well, I do think I have to use some caution in the language here. I think that Ames, when you look at this decision, what the decision ultimately does is it does not settle the case. It sends it back to the lower courts, which is honestly what a lot of the Supreme Court does. But because of that, the left-leaning judges, the justices, they can be on board with basic principles, with basic constitutional interpretation, because it just sends this back to the lower court to apply the proper legal test. It's not outcome determinative. So you're not looking at Ketanji Brown, you're not looking at Sotomayor or anyone else dying on their mantle of liberalism. This is really straightforward because it's applying the law and sending it back to the courts to determine whether the standard is met.
And so if it were outcome determinative, there may have been a little bit more room for the emotional extremism that we've seen from the left wing of the court. That's interesting. And I think, that's a good view for advocates on the conservative side to maybe look at that and have some of these, preemptive challenges and, some of these other things that are more procedural rather than outcome determinative when they're going in front of the Supreme Court, even though hopefully we at least still have the conservative majority. But let's move on as well to the Smith & Wesson Brands v. Mexico. In this case, the court was asked to determine whether the Mexican government could sue 7 gun manufacturers based in the United States over their role in unlawful gun sales in Mexico. And the Supreme Court, again, unanimously, which was surprising, especially in a gun case, that the Mexican government's lawsuit cannot move forward, quote, because Mexico's complaint does not plausibly allege that the defendant gun manufacturers aided and abetted gun dealers' unlawful sales of firearms to Mexican traffickers. We have little doubt, as the complaint asserts, some such sales take place and that the manufacturers know they do. But still, Mexico has not adequately pleaded what it needs to, that the manufacturers, quote unquote, participate in those sales as something that they wish to bring about. And that was Justice Kagan who wrote that opinion.
And that goes back to what you just said earlier, that this is, conservatives are well to remember that when you want to go to the Supreme Court to make an argument, argue process, argue the basics, argue the elements, don't necessarily argue the ultimate outcome. And here, this may have been a gun case, but this is really about what aiding and abetting is. And the First Circuit here imposed a requirement and basically concluded that the gun manufacturer somehow aided and abetted illegal downstate gun sales when this standard was not legally met. Because as Kagan pointed out, aiding and abetting requires taking an affirmative act and intending to facilitate the commission of a crime. And here Mexico never said what that crime is, what that affirmative act was. So because Mexico couldn't meet the pleading standards, there's no aiding and abetting that it could prove, this case failed.
And it should have. And so, this is yet another one that I think conservatives were watching very closely, especially you know, those of us who want to champion the rule of law and the principles of this. And so, you know, with that ruling being unanimous, then, you know, again, to this point, which I think is very good to underscore, this is about just whether the Mexican government could sue, not the ultimate outcome. And so so in the context of the legal liability of gun makers, is this a more narrowly tailored decision that won't necessarily have a lot of impact on other potential similarly situated conflicts in terms of manufacturers' liability in some of these other cases that we've seen, just because this is the Mexican government? Or was it a little bit more broad of a standard?
I think it's a little more broad of a standard. The federal law back in 2005 that protects gun manufacturers, the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, has some very narrow exceptions. And that one of those narrow exceptions is, you know, when gun manufacturers aid and abet or they involve themselves in downstream gun sales that are illegal. And that's really an argument that's hard to make, because gun manufacturers, they're not actively involved in marketing these guns or selling these guns with the intent that they be used or sold illegally. So I think this is a broad enough decision that it will foreclose a lot of new lawsuits against gun manufacturers. I think the plaintiff's bar will have to find more creative ways to try to go after gun manufacturers, because this closed a lot of doors.
That's a great opinion, and especially because it is unanimous and it's broad, as you said. So I'm speaking with Gerard Folletti, who is senior counsel for the Lawfare Project. You can follow him on X at Gerard Folletti. And we need to take a break here, but I'm going to keep Gerard to the other side of this break, because we're going to continue to talk about the Supreme Court opinions. There is still a lot to break down on religious exemptions and a jurisdiction over a foreign state, reopening lawsuits. It's a lot more, but we do have to, unfortunately, take one more break. But we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning with my special guest this morning, Gerard Folletti.
The month of June has been hijacked by the anti-Christian culture to show their pride in something God calls an abomination. When you support AFR, you help us continue to stand for godly values and provide the resources for you to stay in the know about the enemy's tactics. To say thank you for your gift this month, we'll give you the booklet, Inside the LGBTQ Push of the 1990s, to help strengthen your convictions. Just go to afr.net/offers. afr.net/offers.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we're talking about the Supreme Court sending a message yesterday to the American public that, hey, we're maybe not as divided as you think, with four unanimous decisions coming from the High Court, with even Justices Kagan and Sotomayor writing some opinions that actually conservatives can agree with. So, you know, this is kind of bizarro world when you have this happen on the same day that Elon Musk and Donald Trump are now going at it in a very, what looks like, public kind of national divorce. So it was a weird news day yesterday. It was just very weird. But, you know, we're here on a Friday to break it all down and discuss. And so my special guest this morning, Gerard Folletti, who's senior counsel for the Lawfare Project, we're going through some of these opinions. So on religious exemptions, this was Catholic Charities Bureau versus Wisconsin Labor and Industry Review Commission. And the Supreme Court was asked, Gerard, to decide whether the state of Wisconsin was violating the First Amendment's religious freedom protections by denying a faith-based tax break to a group of Catholic nonprofits. And the nonprofit said their service to people in need was clearly motivated by Catholic teachings. Wisconsin officials said they didn't qualify for the religious exemption because they did not seek to serve only Catholics or evangelize to their clients. State officials won in front of the Supreme Court, and in Thursday's unanimous decision, the Supreme Court reversed that Wisconsin Supreme Court decision, ruling that Wisconsin was violating the First Amendment by privileging certain religious beliefs and actions over others. Justice Sotomayor, again, wrote the opinion, and this is part of what she said: it is fundamental to our constitutional order that the government maintain neutrality between religion and religion. There may be hard calls to make in policing that rule, but this is not one. What do you make of this?
Well, a very well-written opinion and very, very accurate. I think the state Supreme Court in Wisconsin really botched this case. It did two things that were very, very wrong. First, it said that the Catholic Charities Bureau's work was secular, even though its motivations were religious, which is kind of stunning when you think about it. But the other part of it is that the state engaged in what we call denominational discrimination. It penalized Catholic charities because the Catholic Church does not proselytize, and it provided services to people of all faiths, not just Catholics. And that's where Sotomayor came in and said, well, you can't do that. You can't discriminate between different denominations in religion. You have to treat them all to the same standard. And if the motivation is religious, if the act is religious, then you have to provide them that exemption under law.
Yeah, and that completely makes sense because as anyone who is part of a faith-based community or even just looking into religion, there are different, widely different practices among religions. And so preferring one over another or having their actions be held to, you know, kind of a minimum standard of what constitutes your religious action in this context to then qualify for a tax break would seem to basically inquire into the adequacy of your religious practice, which would be a really bad can of worms to open. So did this one surprise you, Jared Folletti, that this one was unanimous?
It does not surprise me that this is anonymous because it does hold to what the Supreme Court has done previously, which is it's not looking, it's not performing. The Supreme Court has said that its function is not to assess the religious practices of any group. It's to see whether it is a religious practice, whether it is a religion, and if it is, to accord it the respect that it's entitled to under the First Amendment. So this really is in keeping with Supreme Court precedent. It's interesting to note that Justice Thomas, who concurred, would have gone a little bit farther, basically pointing out that it was wrong to even consider that a charity nonprofit is different from the diocese because it's really an arm of the church.
Interesting. And so, extending that concurrence out to its logical conclusion, I mean, should this and this rationale cover so-called parachurch organizations as well?
It should, because if you look at what Thomas is saying, he's saying that we have this concept, the church autonomy doctrine, where religious institutions are allowed to define how they govern themselves, how they operate. So that would be the natural logical conclusion of what Thomas is arguing. However, we don't see, I mean, his is a concurrence. It's not the unanimous opinion. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in different cases and down the line.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see if some either Catholic or Protestant or, you know, even Jewish or other faiths will kind of jump on that concurrence and litigate in order to get that more broadly into a majority opinion down the line. So let's also talk about jurisdiction over a foreign state. This is the fourth case that was unanimous, and the justices were considering under what circumstances federal courts in the United States can assert jurisdiction over foreign states. So the case stemmed from a conflict between a company that's active in the U.S. and a corporation owned by India. So the Supreme Court on Thursday unanimously ruled that federal courts did have jurisdiction over India in this dispute and reversed a decision from the Ninth Circuit. This was Justice Alito that wrote the opinion. Was this good? And ultimately, why does it matter?
Well, I think what's good is that here we are having more clarification from the Supreme Court on what jurisdiction exists under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. And we have had necessary clarifications by the court. And this really does have a good effect when you look at other cases that are in the pipeline, especially when they can pertain to terrorist financing and cases against the PLO and Palestinian Authority. But essentially what the court is saying is that there is, especially when you have treaties and when you have businesses being conducted, and there is a direct effect under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, when there's commercial activity causing an impact on the United States, this really helps extend a little bit the concept of jurisdiction on foreign companies. And that is a good thing because there's been too many limitations that have been imposed by lower courts.
Mm. Well, and so all of this coming from the high court, and then there was also a ruling on class action lawsuits that was just dismissed as improvidently granted. One justice dissented to that dismissal, and then also a nearly unanimous one justice taking issue with, you know, part of one of the majority of or part of the majority opinion on reopening lawsuits. So the court was considering whether victims of terror attacks or their surviving family members could reopen their case, specifically against a bank that had allegedly aided and abetted terrorists by providing financial services. And the court ruled that those people who brought the case could not reopen their case because they didn't meet the high standard that has to be cleared to reopen it. That majority opinion was authored by Justice Clarence Thomas, nearly unanimous. Jackson only joined in part. That was also an interesting case as well. But in the last few minutes I have with you, Jared Folletti, so what's next? Because the Supreme Court is still set to release around 24 more rulings throughout the month of June as it looks to wrap up the 2024-2025 term by early July or so. Sometimes, as we know from prior sessions, they extend some of their release dates past what is currently on the calendar. But they have yet to announce some really important decisions. So what is pending?
Well, one of the biggest cases that's pending is U.S. v. Scrimeti, and that is really the authority to ban medical procedures. That really has to do with affirming care, that has to do with 14th Amendment issues and parental rights. So that is a mishmash of issues which conservatives and liberals don't ever agree on. And that's not something that's going to be a 9-0 decision. That's something that's going to be closely watched because it will really set the standard on whether states can pass legislation banning transgender or affirming care, whatever it is that they call it. And at the same time, it does raise the issue of parental involvement. We have a case that also involves the ability of parents or the rights of parents to opt their children out of classroom education that contains propaganda, basically indoctrinating on gay and lesbian issues. These are more contentious issues, which I very much doubt will be unanimous or near unanimous. This is where you will see those splits. And we also have cases on the emergency docket or for appeal that involve the president's authority, both under the 14th Amendment to define what birthright citizenship is, and in a lot of these deportation cases that we expect decisions to come down before the court goes into recess.
Yeah, and going back real quickly to the LGBTQ content case, you know, is it, that one, because it is such a high charged court of public opinion issue and social issue, is that one more outcome determinative in the sense that if the majority rules in favor of Scrimeti, then, you know, in the legislation and the ability of states to ban so-called gender-affirming care, then that is outcome determinative. So it's not like the justices on the left can necessarily hide behind some of the procedure like what we were talking about, because this will necessarily have an impact on the community that, you know, unfortunately, I think it's pretty obvious they claim openly from the bench, at least through their argument and their line of reasoning, to represent.
It makes it much harder because this is less procedural and more a merits-based. This is more interpreting what the Constitution says and more creating more additional case law on what parental rights are, which has been a contentious issue for years. Interestingly here, it's the left that's using parental rights to try to burden the court with a decision that will be beneficial for the left. Usually it is the conservatives that are making arguments about parental rights being fundamental and being violated when states or schools especially impose standards or requirements on children that violate their beliefs. Here, it's the left that's saying it's a parental rights issue. So it'll be interesting to see whether the court, and I do think that the court ultimately will find in favor of, you know, protecting this legislation, but it will be more difficult to get there because it has to find a way to do that without addressing parents' rights.
Yeah. Well, and then moving to the second piece of your earlier response about all of the Trump cases and, you know, some of this immigration and all of that. I had a guest on, I think it was last week, NRB General Counsel Mike Ferris, who gave me a stat that I didn't know until provided the actual number that at the time, at least, and who knows, there could have been more, you know, ridiculous lawfare filings from the left since then. But 267, I think was the number that he gave, 267 cases that have been filed in some way challenging Trump's executive actions. Obviously, not all of those can go up and be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's just kind of this, you know, blanket shotgun approach to see what sticks. Are there a few cases that we need to be paying close attention to that would be huge wins for not just Trump's agenda, but conservatism overall?
Well, first of all, I will say I'm surprised, and I hate to say this, I'm surprised that that number is so small. I would have expected it to be bigger. It seems that every day there's another lawsuit challenging anything that the Trump administration is doing. It seems 267 is a pretty small number. In terms of what cases to watch for, it's hard to keep track of the different names of the cases because essentially the arguments come down to the same thing, that the Trump administration is not following the Administrative Procedures Act, that the Trump administration is not following due process requirements. So the names of the cases are not as important as what the arguments actually are. And all of these cases essentially boil down to Trump is violating due process and Trump is violating the administration. Whichever one of these cases makes it up to the Supreme Court first, I think the outcome will be very, very determinative for all the others.
Yeah, well, well said. Well, Gerard Folletti, really appreciate all of your legal analysis, breaking down all of this for us on a Friday. So have a great weekend. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Tune in to On Demand today, where I'm talking to James Lindsay about critical immigration theory. You're not going to want to miss it. Go to AFR.net, click on podcasts.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.